Buns. Maybe he ate something from the fridge that had spoiled once the power went out. Our uncle was always scavenging our refrigerator for leftovers that my mom would toss if she got to it first. "Where's Daphne?" I ask.
"Resting," he tells me. "She's not feeling well either."
Kelton gives me a worried look. I'm not sure what it's about, but as I lift the water to my mouth, he stops me. Then he checks his own cup, sniffing it, then taking a sip.
"It's good," he says.
"Why wouldn't it be?" I look at the bottle our uncle poured from. It's Agua Viva, which, as I recall, is ridiculously expensive. You can buy wine for less.
"You hungry?"
our uncle asks.
"Still got some canned stuff. Not much variety, but what are you gonna do?"
I take a look in the pantry just to see how well stocked they are. It's mostly condiment bottles, like a dozen different kinds of salsas. There are Sara Lee cake mixes and the types of canned goods that sit for years until you need them. Things like pineapple chunks and sliced olives. Plenty of them, but no one's choice for a meal.
"No thanks," I tell him.
"We're good." And upon seeing what's there, no one disagrees. We're all hungry, but had eaten well at Kelton's house the day before. And if this is all they have for themselves, I don't want to take it. Then Kelton does something weird. He goes to the faucet and turns it on. Of course, nothing comes out, but then he sniffs the spout. He turns to our uncle.
"So I hear there was water here after the tap out."
"Yeah, for a while," Uncle Basil tells him.
"They hooked up the old water tank. Kept the water flowing a couple of days. Just dribbling, really. Not enough to bathe with, but enough to drink."
Kelton nods, then turns to me again. "Elissa, could I talk to you for a minute?" Then he takes my arm and leads me into the dining room. I shake his hand off once we get there. I don't like being pulled places. "What's so important that we couldn't talk in there?"
"Elissa, we have to get out of here," he says, in an intense whisper.
"I'm working on it," I tell him. "I can't just show up, take his truck, and leave."
"You don't get it," he says, in that same whisper that's almost maniacal. "Don't you think it's strange how quiet the streets are?"
And come to think of it, I did find it strange. Everywhere else we've been, however quiet, it's still pointed toward life. But this place doesn't even show the slightest trace of it. He gets closer to me, not as loud, but still just as intense.
"I'm pretty sure that the tap water was bad. Worse than bad. I think your uncle has dysentery. Maybe all of Dove Canyon has."
I don't know much about dysentery, other than that it's seriously bad diarrhea that people in third world countries get.
"So, what do we do?"
Kelton shakes his head.
"There's nothing we can do. Not without a whole lot of medicines we don't have."
He takes a moment to gauge me, making sure he has gotten through. He has, but it doesn't mean I have to like the message.
"We shouldn't touch anything," he says, "and definitely shouldn't eat anything."
"It's all in cans," I argue, even though I have no intention of eating it.
"Yes, but anything he touches could be contaminated."
I can't argue with it. As paranoid as it sounds, it's probably true. And when we go back into the kitchen, Uncle Basil is serving Garrett a bowl of pineapple chunks.
"It wasn't me," Garrett says. "Uncle Basil insisted."
Our uncle puts a spoon in front of him.
"You need your energy. I know it isn't much, but I won't let you guys go hungry on my watch."
Resigned, Garrett reaches for the spoon.
"Don't,"
I say sharply. I almost slap the spoon away. I turn to our sick uncle. My action spoke pretty clearly, so I don't hide my reason. "It's the tap water that made you sick, Uncle Herb," I tell him, to cut through any denial he might be in.
It's dysentery, which could be contagious, so we shouldn't eat anything you've touched. I'm sorry. He sighs, realizing I'm right and maybe mad at himself for not considering that already. Then open a fresh can. I have some hand sanitizer. But Garrett pushes away from the table, no appetite for anything. It's okay. I'm not very hungry anyway. I'm realizing now that our uncle has no idea how sick he and Daphne might be. And then Jackie says, I'll take you up on that hand sanitizer. As I look to her, I can tell she's having a flash of fever again. She points to her wound, which is oozy and clearly needs redressing. And gauze, too, if you have any. Sure, my uncle says. He grabs the hand sanitizer, but first cleans his own hands and the bottle before handing it to her with a pained smile. Upstairs, second door on the left. Should be a first aid kit under the sink. I watch her go upstairs, and then I realize something. Jackie has antibiotics. I'm not sure where they are now. In her pocket? Still out in the BMW? Or in the commotion, did she leave them back at Kelton's house? Would I take them from her to give to my uncle? No, I tell myself. I might not like Jackie all that much, but I won't steal from her. I would never hurt one person's chances to help another, even if that other person was someone I cared about. If I did, I'd be no better than the marauders. You should leave, I tell my uncle. Both you and Daphne. They're setting up shelters. They might not have water yet, but they'll have medicine. I'm sure they will. But he swats the idea away. I don't think Daphne is really up to travel. And we've gotten through the worst of it already. I don't know if he means the worst of his sickness or the worst of the crisis. Either way, my response is the same. I think the worst is still coming. Still, nothing I say will persuade him. We'll be fine. And more than anything, I want to believe him. But my days of sitting still and hoping for the best are over. Now hope is a thing in constant motion, like a shark.
Jackie.
I find the bathroom, shut the door behind me, and reach into my pocket, pulling out one of the two orange containers of antibiotics. I can't remember which one I started with, but why does it matter? I examine the little two-tone green capsules. Astonishing to think that these tiny pods rolling around in the palm of my hand mean the difference between life and death. I'll bet they're worth their weight in gold 100 times over right now. Then again, you can never put a price on human life, so it's down the hatch they go. Next comes the bandage. I find the first aid kit right where Basil or Herb or Dill or whatever the hell his actual name is said it would be. The bandage sticks to my arm as I peel it off, the wound healing into the cloth itself. Well, at least it's healing. I clean it thoroughly, and painfully, with alcohol swabs, careful not to touch anything that might infect me, then redress the wound. Good as new. I wander a bit upstairs, checking the place out. This is some house. The kind I wouldn't mind squatting in under different circumstances. Although the decor is a little too prissy for my tastes. Basil's girlfriend must be the doily and lace type. What was her name again? Should be Rosemary, I think, which makes me chuckle. I make my way back toward the staircase, passing the double doors to the master bedroom, and notice that one is slightly ajar. Through the crack, I can make out the silhouette of a woman lying motionless in an all-white bed. There's an acrid smell wafting from the room, dark and decrepit. Where anyone else would walk away, I'm pulled closer, drawn to the scene with a gravity I find hard to resist. The call of the void. I push the door open wider and take a single step over the threshold. It's like leaning into the wind at the edge of a cliff. Over the bed flows one of those decorative mosquito nets fit for a queen, but here it seems to be keeping disease in rather than out. Daphne. That's her name. This ailing empress must be Daphne. The silence in here is overwhelming. And then I realize why. The woman isn't breathing. Now it's more than just the void pulling at me. It's the scene of a car crash. It's the rubble after a tornado. I have to get closer. I won't touch her. I won't cross the barrier of that net, but I have to see. I have to look at her chest to see if it rises and falls. I need to know. And the smell now, it's terrible. Bile and sulfur and all the fetid organic stenches we fight all our lives to keep at bay. Then, before I'm close enough to get a good look, she moves, shifting slightly beneath the covers. My heart pounds in my chest so loud that I think she hears it, because she slowly lolls her head in my direction, and when she looks at me, her eyes are dark and glassy. She's too weak to speak, or even to wonder what a stranger is doing in her home. She's not dead, but her body doesn't know it, because I think it's already beginning to decompose. And although she still looks at me, our gazes somehow don't connect. That's when I realize that it's not me she sees at all. She sees the void. A few moments later, I'm downstairs again with the others, but I'm quiet, to myself. Because over everything, I see Daphne's image burned across my retina. Alyssa is trying to convince Basil to go with Daphne to an evacuation center, but of course he refuses. And the more she tries to convince him, the further he's pushed away. I wonder if he realizes how bad off Daphne is. On some level, he must. And although he's holding it together for his niece and nephew, I don't think he's all that far from crawling into that bed with her and letting the end come. Then I realize with a shiver that the scene upstairs is likely happening in many of the homes around us. This gated community has become a high-end morgue. Alyssa hasn't asked for her uncle's keys yet. This polite streak of hers is going to get her killed, and us along with her. Apparently Kelton's patience has also run out, because he's the one who cuts to the chase.
If you're not leaving, then let us borrow your truck. We need four-wheel drive to get us where we're going.
I would if I could,
he says, embarrassed, some color actually returning to his face.
But I traded it.
For what? I blurt out.
For that agua viva you've all been drinking. I'll get it back as soon as this whole thing blows over,
he says, looking down.
I mean, I'm sure a thing like that can't be legally binding.
Who'd you trade it to? Alyssa asks. Again, he looks down, ashamed.
Some kid up the hill.
The house is obnoxiously huge. Like the rest of the houses around it, built out to as close to the edge of the property line as allowable by law. It's freshly painted in an off-brown color, like someone tried to give it a Brazilian spray tan. It's what's commonly referred to as a McMansion, an ostentatious home thrown up in an assembly line fashion while you wait. The garage door is cracked open about 3 inches from the ground and spewing fumes. I can hear a generator inside, which means the house has its own electricity source. Apparently, actually putting the generator outside where it belongs leaves it open to theft. This kid's no idiot. Over the drone of the generator, I can hear electronic dance music playing inside the house. Okay, maybe he is. Alyssa ignores the big, brass, Oz-like knocker and pounds directly on the door. Nothing. I can tell she's getting pissed because she starts pounding and doesn't stop until the door finally opens, revealing a good-looking, well-groomed kid in a dark blue Letterman jacket from Santa Margarita Catholic High School and a polo shirt underneath. A Letterman jacket in this heat? Yes, the generator is keeping the air conditioning on, but the jacket still seems off. I tuck it away in my weird crap I don't care enough about to question file. Basil told us that the kid's parents were out of town. A silver spoon preppy type left home alone. God help us all. He smiles brightly.
How can I help you?
He says, like we were about to order a cheeseburger and fries from his McMansion.
I'm here for my uncle's truck, Alyssa demands.
he exercises his right to refuse service to anyone.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Then he quickly tries to shut the door. That's when I jam my foot in. He leans against the door, keeping pressure.
1 foot in my home constitutes trespassing,
he belts, trying to sound much more intimidating than he really is. Maybe the Oz knocker is appropriate.
There are severe legal ramifications if you don't get your foot out of my door.
I lean my shoulder into it. Open the door, asshole. Alyssa and Garrett join in, applying pressure.
My father is a lawyer. He'll shove a lawsuit so far up your...
Before he can even finish his idle threat, Kelton hurls himself against the door as well, and his added force sends the door flying open, knocking the preppy kid down. He scrambles to his feet, treading Persian rug. Then he suddenly turns, reaches into a foyer credenza drawer, and produces a gun. Damn it. No sudden movements, I think, as my hand very slowly creeps toward the gun hidden in my waistband.
That's right. Stay back. Hands where I can see them,
he says, quoting something I'm sure he saw on TV. We all freeze except for Kelton. Instead, Kelton strides toward the kid. He really has lost it. The preppy kid tightens his grip on his gun and shouts almost maniacally,
I'm fully within my rights to shoot. I swear I'll do it.
But Kelton is fearless. He suddenly lurches forward, grips the boy's wrist, and all in one motion twists his arm behind his back. The kid yelps, but Kelton isn't finished. He pushes the kid's arm up behind his back and twists him around so his own momentum is his enemy. His arm is now bent at an obscene angle, and we all hear a pop. The preppy kid falls to the floor, screaming bloody murder, and Kelton holds the gun. For a moment, he looks just as surprised as we do, as if he's saying to himself, holy crap, it worked. While the kid still writhes on the floor, Kelton examines the gun.
Kelton, are you out of your mind? Alyssa says. He could have killed you.
Nope, Kelton says. This is a WG Panther. It's an airsoft gun. Which means it's nothing but a toy. Look, the orange tip is colored black with a Sharpie.
I'm so infuriated that I was tricked by a freaking airsoft gun, I get the sudden urge to kick this kid in the gut. And then I remember that his arm is totally popped out of its socket. Serves him right. Kelton gets down on one knee to help him, but the preppy kid scrambles back and points with his working arm.
No! Keep that psychopath away from me!
He screams. It's refreshing to hear someone else be called a psychopath for once. Ironically enough, this guy should be thanking Kelton for what he did, because if he hadn't disarmed him, I would have done it myself. And real guns don't shoot plastic pellets.
Let him help,
Alyssa tells the kid. He knows what he's doing. And for some reason, he listens. People seem to trust Alyssa for better or worse. I trust her like I trust Kung Pao chicken in a frat guy's mini fridge. Just enough to not vomit. Kelton has the kid lie on his back and firmly holds his arm.
Take a deep breath and hold it,
Kelton says, gripping tight.
Ready? 1, 2,
and on 3, Kelton pops his shoulder back into place. The kid yelps, but a little less loudly than when it was first dislocated. He then sits up and leans against the wall, sweating.
Ice! Get me ice, will you?
He demands, to anyone. The words almost don't even register. Ice? This kid has ice? Come to think of it, he has a lot of things that other people don't.
In the kitchen,
he says, mistaking our shock for stupidity. Sure thing, Roycroft, I say with a smirk and nod to Garrett, who goes off to get it. The kid glares at me, now as confused as he is angry. Don't be so surprised, I say. Your name's on your jacket.
Oh, right.
There, now we're on a last-name basis.
I still don't know your name.
No, you don't. Funny how that works. I look around, trying to calculate our current situation, but the numbers just aren't adding up. It's an embarrassment of riches, a stack of laptops, multiple Xboxes. Who has multiple Xboxes?
There's a bunch of signed sports memorabilia, and at the far end of a hall is some sort of tank with a giant... I spin around, barely even able to look at it. Oh, snake! I center myself, take a deep, calming breath, reminded of the one thing I have in common with Indiana Jones besides proficiency with a whip. But that's another conversation. I turn to him. He's moved himself to a leather sofa, still holding his shoulder. So what's with all this stuff? I ask. He somehow manages to flash a cool smile, even in his most emasculated state. Assets that I've acquired, fair and square. Alyssa steps forward. Was it fair when you took my uncle's truck? Of course, he replies, taken aback by the mere suggestion of impropriety. I have all the paperwork. You took advantage of him. The price of water has gone up, he says, getting defensive. Don't tell me that's my fault. Alyssa curls a fist, ready to dislocate more of his body parts, which I'd actually pay to see. He came to me, the preppy kid says, still offended by the indictment of his character. Kelton is already growing impatient. The water here is tainted. What's the point of having all this junk if you're just going to get sick like the rest of them? I didn't drink it. I have my own means of hydration. You haven't left here, have you? Kelton realizes. You haven't seen what it's like out there. And this seems to give him pause for thought. It must be true. This little prince has been living on his own personal planet since the tap out. Why are you here alone anyway? I ask. My parents are on a cruise. They left me to watch the house. I'm sure they'd come home if they weren't in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Lucky them, I say. Garrett hands him a skimpy bag of ice and he holds it to his shoulder. Have you been watching the news at all? Alyssa asks. He shakes his head. The TV drains too much power from the generator. He leads us to a family room that looks more like a home theater with a 60-inch TV, which, as he said, eats up so much juice from the generator, the lights dim when he turns it on. Kelton grabs the remote and finds the local news channel, except now the entire channel is just color bars. Kelton tries the other local channel. Static. I want to believe it's a problem with the provider and not with the stations themselves. Kelton flips to a national broadcast, CNN, and we finally see a report. But I almost wish we hadn't. Although it shows us what we already know, somehow seeing it in huge, high-def color makes it worse. There's a map of Southern California, a circle around it, like the highlighted path of a hurricane. Southern California tap-out coverage is what the chyrons read at the bottom, like this was some kind of event for everyone else's entertainment. I've been on the receiving end of broadcasts like this from other places, but this is the first time in as long as I can remember that I'm standing in the epicenter of the disaster area. I turn to the others and realize that they're all just as shaken as I am, even the preppy kid. It's finally happened, says Alyssa. The rest of the world finally noticed and is taking the tap out seriously. The rest of the world is too late, says Kelton. And he's right. You don't wait nearly a week until mobilizing serious resources for a disaster of this magnitude. The reports flash across the screen and blend together, my brain hardly able to register it all. A reporter in a chopper flies over downtown Los Angeles, showing rioting that makes the L.A. riots of the 90s seem like a tea party. There's a journalist reporting from the fringes of Riverside, at a safe distance, peering inside the fishbowl of chaos, afraid to travel too deep. A group of elementary school kids in Florida hold a bottled water drive, as if any of their water will actually get here in time to make a difference. There's a shot of FEMA officials, actual FEMA, not just their reserve volunteers, handing out water in an evacuation center, but a wider shot reveals more crowds than they can possibly handle. Rock stars plan relief concerts to raise funds, celebrities promote charities, all the usual self-congratulatory stuff. The only difference is that we're the victims now, rather than the ones sitting comfortably in our homes, sending $5 on a charity app and patting ourselves on the back because we're so goddamn generous. If you're getting this report and you're in the Southland right now, there is a mandatory evacuation, says Anderson Cooper. His image is accompanied by shots of military personnel helping families evacuate onto massive trucks, handing out water to long lines of people. Evacuation centers are being set up throughout Southern California in school gymnasiums, churches, and malls. But there seems to be a staggering number of people who are choosing not to cooperate with these government mandates. Look on the bright side, I say. At least malls have a purpose again. The next shot shows mobs of people flowing like a human river down a winding mountain road and disappearing beneath a forest canopy. These families are making their own way toward Lake Arrowhead and the Big Bear Lake area, but reports on the ground tell us that people who have been entering many of these woodsy areas aren't coming out on the other side. Everyone watches silently, and then I turn to Kelton. Hey, bug out boy. If they're not making it through the forest, what makes you think we will? I told you we're not going where they're going. And that's good, because if all those people aren't getting to the High Lakes, there's only one of two places they're going. And neither of them are places you come back from.
Henry.
Dealing with irrational people takes focus, intelligence, and extreme discipline. You have to maintain a sense of true emotional stasis, as outlined in one of my favorite books, Transformative Power by Pierce Tidwell. One must learn to manage one's emotional state in order to consistently operate from a place of resourcefulness, thus producing desirable outcomes. You have to be actionary rather than reactionary. Which is why, instead of giving in to the god-awful throbbing pain in my right shoulder, I channel it, using the pain as a tool to sharpen my focus. It really hurts, though. Sweet Jesus, how it hurts. I won't allow it to control me. My current agony will not define me. Instead, my profound discomfort will be a springboard that will propel me toward a better reality. Until now, I have mostly avoided watching the news. It's always so manipulative. But now I can't help but acknowledge that the tap-out is a tragedy, and the relief effort a travesty. The cities are clearly hit hardest, the crumbling, impoverished areas packed with marginalized people unequipped for societal disaster. But there is always opportunity in misfortune. So the question is, how do I turn this to my advantage? Because, after all, you can't work for the greater good unless you have all of your own ducks in a row first. All considered, it may be in my best interest to fly the coop rather than sit on my current nest egg. Then again, if the state of things has really devolved to such a degree, my water must be worth more than ever. Everything that I've traded for thus far will be peanuts compared to what my next transactions will bring. I'm busting inside, but I keep my cool. One must never overreact to the spoils of one's windfall. I decide it's best to take an inventory of my current liquid assets. So I get up and head to my dad's home office, where the rest of my agua viva is. "Where are you going, Roycroft?" the toughish girl with the perpetual smirk says. I say tough-ish, because I doubt she's as tough as she wants everyone to think. But I won't deny that there may be a screw or two loose. "To get more ice," I reply. Which they all buy, because they don't follow me. They're still glued to the television screen. I guess with my arm like this, they don't see me as much of a threat. Which is a big mistake. As long as they underestimate me, I have an advantage. I close the door to the office, ensuring my privacy, and pull out the last box of agua viva. It's a fairly large box, containing two cases. I pry the box open to reveal a new and unexpected wrinkle to my current situation. Life is rife with many moments of misfortune, which we must learn to see as opportunities. Misfortune, oh say, like opening up a box that you think contains 48 water bottles, only to find that it's full of agua viva independent multi-tiered distributor brochures instead. In these situations, one must keep a level head. A very level head. I hold on to the one positive in this personal debacle. At least now I won't have to struggle to make a decision as to whether to stay or go. I don't have much of a choice now. I'm going to have to leave here. My generator will soon be out of gas anyway, and I can hide my acquired assets in the attic behind the boxes of Christmas ornaments. Except, of course, for the python. But that thing can go for weeks without food. Plus, I assume it's well acclimated to hot climates. Ultimately, a place of greater safety might not be a bad idea. And if Dove Canyon really is the bacterial petri dish my uninvited guests are making it out to be, I'd imagine any place will be better than this. In which case, their arrival is a lucky thing indeed. But I could have done without the dislocated shoulder. I seal up the huge cardboard box as securely as I can with strapping tape, and then I tape it again and again, so it'll be virtually impossible to open. That's when one of them comes in. It's the more reasonable, less snarky of the two girls. The one who's laying claim to her uncle's former truck.
I thought you were getting ice.
All out, I say convincingly. Which reminded me to check my water supply. I rap on the box and point to the giant Agua Viva logo on the side. There's a brief lull in the conversation. And I know exactly where this is going. It can only go one way. The truck. They're not going to leave until they get what they want. There's four of them and one of me. Clearly, I'm not going to be able to overpower them, especially with their psychotic red-haired pit bull around. I just have to write the truck off as a short-term loss leader, because when it comes down to it, I'm no longer in a position to negotiate. But she hasn't realized that yet. And right now it's just the two of us. So I beat her to the punch. We never officially met, I say, turning on the charm. I'm Henry. I extend my left arm to shake, since I can still barely move my right. She hesitates, a little skeptical. Understandable. My name's Alyssa. Pleasure to meet you, Alyssa. I smile and clear my throat. I'll tell you what. I appreciate the passion that you have for your friends and family's well-being, and can see why you might feel entitled to that truck. She crosses her arms, but she's still listening. So I'm prepared to give it to you. I pause for effect. But only under one condition. She lifts an eyebrow. You take me with you. She thinks it over, but I can already feel things tipping in my favor. I once read in The Thriving Executive by R.J. Sherman that the number one way to sustain a job in this day and age is to make yourself indispensable. Or at least make people think you're indispensable. She deliberates. And just when I sense that I've reached that tipping point where her emotions and better judgment teeter ever so precariously, I give her the gentle tap that ensures which way she'll fall. I'll bring this Agua Viva box, I say, with an ingratiating smile. We could just take your Agua Viva, she points out. True, but you're not that kind of person. The others might be, but you're not. And I can see by the look in her eye that she's free-falling toward a unilateral decision. If they take me, they get what they want, and I get to ensure my own survival. Another win-win. The toughish girl, whose name I find out is Jackie, insists on driving. Fair enough. For now. As we drive down my street, I begin to think I may have totally underestimated the effect of the water shortage on this community. It's one thing to see rioting on TV in dense urban areas that are more prone to social conflagration, but quite a different thing to see homes with broken windows in an upscale community like Dove Canyon. Not that the affluent are any better. I mean, human nature is human nature. However, where personal space is at a premium, tensions are apt to spike much more quickly than in a place where one's battle cry reaches maybe 10 neighbors instead of 100. Which means that in the suburbs and exurbs, it's hard to generate the critical mass needed to ignite truly bad behavior. Or maybe not. Because as we drive off, there's more evidence of bad behavior than just broken windows. There are shattered mailboxes, cars that have jumped curbs into hedges, and the kind of random debris that one generally doesn't find in a turnkey community like this one. Not because people here aren't Slavs. I'm sure a lot of them are. But they're so obsessively worried about their property values that they'd rather die than allow the detritus of civilization to sully their curb appeal. "I'm worried about leaving my uncle," says Alyssa, who sits beside me in the back seat. She's a buffer between me and the psychotic red-headed kid on her other side. I would have preferred to sit in the front seat, but Alyssa's brother called it, and if we don't adhere to the convention of calling shotgun, what rule of law is left to us?
"Uncle Parsley will be fine," says Jackie, "and even if he's not, there's nothing you can do about it. You asked him to come and he wouldn't. End of story."
Alyssa accepts the wisdom, but doesn't seem comforted. "Well, he's got plenty of agua viva," I point out. "Even if it's going right through him, he'll still get the benefits of the electrolytes. In fact, its proprietary formula is proven to improve quality of life."
"Great, just what we need," says Jackie. "An infomercial with good hair."
This is what one calls a backhanded compliment. I choose to see the positive, because that's how I roll. "That information could save lives," I tell her, "and so can good hair in the right situation." The truck is still hot. The air conditioner has been blowing since we got in, but it's no cooler. Jackie notices that too, because she starts checking the controls.
"What's wrong with this thing?" she asks.
"That's right, I forgot. The air conditioner doesn't work,"
Alyssa informs us.
"Our uncle kept saying he was going to get it fixed, but never got around to it."
Jackie glares at her.
"You could have told us that before."
We all crank down the windows, but it's just as hot outside as it is in the car. The digital thermometer on the dashboard reads 98 degrees. Body temperature feels so much hotter when it's outside of your body. Her uncle should have disclosed that the air conditioner didn't work when he made the deal with me. Legally, you have to disclose things like that. Then Alyssa's brother turns around and asks me,
"What sport did you let her in?"
I point to the patches on my jacket, which is increasingly wrong for the weather, but I refuse to shed it. "This one's soccer," I say, which seems to grab Alyssa's attention, although I can tell she's trying not to show it. "And this one's lacrosse."
"Lacrosse," says Jackie. "I'm not surprised you're good with a stick."
I choose not to comment. Alyssa looks at another patch.
"Captain of the debate team?"
I shrug like it's nothing. I make a good argument.
"How about the tattoos on your wrist?"
asks Alyssa's brother, pointing to the words peeking out from beneath my sleeve.
"What are they?"
"They're not tattoos," I tell him. "It's just standard ink."
"So what do they say?"
I pull up the sleeves of my letterman's jacket a bit and try to lift my arm to show him, but my shoulder throbs. My dislocation is a gift that keeps on giving. I'm able to get it high enough for him to see the words, though. He reads them haltingly.
"Conflagration detritus."
My words of the day. Alyssa looks at me, a bit amused.
"You write vocabulary words on your arm?"
"One's vocabulary needs constant fertilizing or it will die," I say, quoting Evelyn Waugh. Not that I know who Evelyn Waugh is, but knowing the source of a quote is what counts. By the time it fades, the word is permanently committed to memory.
"I got a few words I'd like to write on your arm," says Jackie.
As we come to the gate of my community, I can see that it's blocked by a barricade of sorts. Another sign of how deep the crisis has cut. It must have been designed by a committee, because it's a fairly pathetic barrier. Like something beavers might have erected if they had opposable thumbs and lots of upper body strength.
"I forgot about that," says Jackie. "Maybe we can just roll over it,"
suggests Psycho Ginger.
"This truck has a pretty high chassis."
"Why risk damaging her uncle's truck?" I say. "We'll get out and dismantle it." It's really the only reasonable course of action, but by saying it first, it helps to move me a few inches closer to a position of leadership. We all get out to clear a path to the gate. I'm not as effective as I'd like to be, however, and Jackie notices.
What's the matter, Roycroft? Is heavy lifting beneath your pay grade?
Leave him alone, says Garrett. His shoulder's messed up.
I grin and give her a one-shouldered shrug. With enough of a path cleared, we get back into the truck. I get back in next to Alyssa. It's a bit cramped in the back, but to be honest, I don't mind. Look at that, I say as we drive out of the gate. Someone actually abandoned a BMW by the side of the road.
Yeah, says Jackie. What idiots.
As we pull away from Dove Canyon, I take a moment to do a more in-depth assessment of my travel companions. Alyssa seems to be the one calling the shots, although Jackie wants to be. Then there's Alyssa's little brother, who stood up for me back at the gate, so I think I've already won him over. And then there's the crazy kid. He's the part of this equation I wish would just cancel out. I know the type. Angry, sadistic, sociopathic. He's probably a dropout, on the way to being a career criminal. Drug dealer type. Yeah. The kind of guy who beats up Eagle Scouts for fun. I won't even try to gain his confidence. For now, I focus on Jackie. I try to decipher her. A lot of people probably think she's Latina because of her complexion, but she's not. Her intonations and body language point elsewhere. Her eyes and the cast of her brow feel more European. She catches me in the rearview mirror watching her, so I don't shy away from it. Italian? I ask, taking a wild guess.
Greek, she answers. But I can't see how that's any of your business.
Greco-Roman, then, I say. I wasn't entirely wrong. Then I add, you have a classic look. If Venus de Milo had arms, she'd look like you.
If Venus de Milo had arms, she'd slap you around, she responds.
How about us? Asks Alyssa's brother.
Garrett, don't even bother, Alyssa says. Nobody gets it right.
But still, Garrett waits for me to try. I'm on shaky ground here because, considering the volatile nature of our society, if I get it wrong, I'm likely to offend. I would say your family hails from multiple continents. Alyssa is impressed.
That's sort of right.
Then Garrett chimes in with,
we're a quarter Dutch, a quarter French-Canadian, a quarter Jamaican, and a quarter Ukrainian.
A fine melting pot, I say. What my father would call a full-flavored stew. Actually, my father would call them mutts, but my father can be an asshole. His is a tree I strive to fall increasingly farther from. Anyway, I say, it's a much broader genealogy than your Viking friend here.
We're not Scandinavian, snaps Kelton. We're Scottish and English. I have an ancestor who came over on the Mayflower.
Really? I ask. A rat or a roach? Which I feel safe saying because Alyssa's between us, although he might make me pay for it later when no one else is looking. But it makes Garrett laugh. And Garrett's laughter makes Alyssa smile, so it's worth the risk. With the exception of Mr. Mayflower, I'm beginning to feel at home with this little group. They say that intense communal experiences can create lasting friendships. I think there's real opportunity here.
What about you?
Alyssa asks. I have no idea, I tell her. I'm adopted. As we drive, the desolation around us makes it hard to keep spirits up. Everywhere things seem as hopeless as my neighborhood. At least the people out here don't have dysentery, I think. But if not having dysentery is where the bar is set, that's pretty low. Morale is everything in difficult times. It's the only thing that can keep stress from becoming toxic. But morale doesn't just happen. It starts with management and trickles all the way down. I see it as my responsibility to ignore the emptiness of the streets, the non-functional stoplights, and the occasional clusters of walking dead. You can't get caught up in that kind of stuff. If my decisions reflected this abysmal reality, how could things ever get better? I realize that this group needs more than just a competent leader. They need a hero. I resolve to do my best to rise to the occasion.
Snapshot 1 of 2. CH-47D, Chinook. Alice Marasco isn't new to the skies, but has never before flown her chopper as a first responder. However, now that martial law has been declared and the National Guard has been activated, Alice has been called on to airlift drinking water to evacuation centers. Like everyone else, she has come late to the realization that this crisis, from a human standpoint, is just as severe as any natural disaster, because of the sheer number of people affected and the desperate position every single one of them is in. Yes, there was warning, years of it in fact, but public service announcements about conservation are a whole lot different from a total stoppage. There was no warning at all that the water would simply turn off. Alice often visits an uncle with dementia who lives in a nursing home in Tustin, a community right in the heart of the affected area. And because Alice hasn't been able to confirm that he's been safely evacuated, she finds herself pulled slightly off route and flying in the direction of his nursing home. Even though she wouldn't be able to make out much from this altitude, she needs to get a sense of things, an overview that can at least give her a little bit of comfort. She scans the streets below, not even sure what she's looking for. She remembers reports of how, during disasters, nursing homes are among the hardest hit. They don't command the resources or attention that hospitals do, and often they're severely understaffed, leaving such places barely equipped to deal with a normal day, much less a crisis. There are Facebook pages for dozens of neighborhoods where people have started checking themselves in as safely evacuated and with access to water, because those two things don't necessarily go together. Those pages have actually become the most accurate registry of evacuees. She's been checking it for people she knows but hasn't come across any, least of all her uncle, to whom social media means sitting in a crowded room reading a newspaper. Her uncle's neighborhood looks just like most others. Lifeless, except for overcrowded, overflowing evacuation centers, looking like anthills, spaced out at 5-mile intervals. The lifeless places look fake from an aerial view, like a miniature with plastic trees or a felted architectural model. She can't take the time to find the specific building, but even if she did, what could she do? When her co-pilot points out that they're slightly off course, she adjusts their direction and lets it go. Up ahead is one of those swarming pockets of life. Thousands of people all congregating in a shopping center parking lot. From this altitude, it appears the way Coachella or any major festival would look, which is disturbing to her because entertainment is the last thing these people want right now. They've cleared a huge circle in the lot. Crowds have pushed themselves back to create a landing pad, a makeshift heliport for her supply of life-giving water. But there's nothing Alice can do for these people. This isn't her destination. This isn't even an official evacuation center. And then she's hit with a gust of emotion, an inner turbulence that shakes her to her core. She starts doing the math. At this point, there are about 200 evacuation shelters. Even if only half the population went to a shelter, that means nearly 12 million people would be there, waiting for water. That's 60,000 people for each shelter. And yet the choppers in service can only provide enough water for about 6,000 people per shelter per day. Which means that 9 in 10 people won't get water today. And that's just in the official centers. Tears begin to cloud her vision, but she wipes them away. Maybe the water in her chopper is just a drop in the bucket, but it's going to help someone somewhere. And for the others, there's nothing she can do. And so she passes over the crowded parking lot, but not before saying a silent prayer for the souls below.
Snapshot 2 of 2. Target. 6. That's how many helicopters have soared right over Hallie's head since she got to the Target parking lot yesterday. Everyone says the military helicopters are transporting water, that they're going to land here and save everyone. That's why the people in charge keep clearing places for the choppers to land. That's why every family has someone waiting in a long, winding line just in case there's something to line up for. The sound of another chopper rises in the north. Everyone looks up in anticipation. The sound peaks, its shadow crosses the lot. That's the closest it comes. The sound of its engine fades as it disappears to the south. That makes 7. We won't get the military deliveries, a woman beside her says, to anyone who'll listen. Or maybe just to herself. But the other helicopters, they're coming to unofficial drop points. She lights a cigarette to console herself. There's more non-military choppers out there anyway. Where? Hallie wants to ask her. What helicopters are you talking about? Certainly none that are big enough to ship water. Most small choppers can barely hold a handful of passengers, and water is heavy. Does this woman really think some sightseeing company is sending them water? She returns to her mother, who has staked out a position in line. Only about 30 from the front, folding chair and all. She doesn't have the spot because they got there early, but because she saw a friend in line when they arrived, and offered to hold her place when she went to the bathroom. The friend had since abandoned the parking lot for the hope of greener pastures, leaving Hallie's mom to inherit the spot. That's the way her mom has always been. She finds ways to get what she wants. Bastards, Hallie's mom mutters under her breath as Hallie sits on the ground next to her. No explanation of which bastards she's referring to. It's obvious. The bastards in the helicopters that fly by, and everyone else ignoring this lot. The water gods rolling the dice to decide which way that water will go. Next one will be for us, Hallie tells her. She offers Hallie a slim smile. They both know it's wishful thinking that borders on delusion, but right now, it's all they have. They have no choice in the matter. Water must come to them, because they're not going anywhere. Her mom is not abandoning her place in line. They had water on the first couple days of the tap out. Her mom had ripped the case out of the hands of one of Hallie's soccer teammates back at Costco. You snooze, you lose, her mom said, once they got to the checkout line. Let that be a life lesson. But there were clearly life lessons that her mom had missed, like, don't wash your hair when all you have is bottled water, and skip your morning jog when sweat is the enemy. And maybe the most obvious one of them all, let the houseplants die. That case of water lasted only 2 days. Out on the street, just beyond the parking lot, a little red Volkswagen bus pulls up. The kind of thing you might have seen at Woodstock. A minivan, built before there was such a thing as a minivan. It was here yesterday, too. Twice. Today, 3 girls around her age, maybe a little bit older, get out. She can't see the driver, but she knows it's a man. She knows this instinctively. Hallie, honey, her mother says, trying to shield her eyes from the sun. Why don't you go into the shade where it's cooler? Against the side of the building. Maybe listen to what people are saying. Maybe get some information. What people say is useless, Hallie points out. Mostly, yes, but every once in a while there might be something worth listening to. She hates leaving her mother sweltering here, but she's been given a mission, and so she goes. All the while thinking of the things the two of them have had to do over the last couple of days to get this far. When they were still at home, Hallie's mom flirted with Mr. Widener, a neighbor who had gotten divorced last year. Truth was, Hallie's mom always flirted with him. But when she realized he had water, she flirted with him just a little bit more. He was polite about it, and although he didn't really flirt back, he did offer them a bottle of water. Mission accomplished, her mother had said when they got home, although she had trouble looking Hallie in the eye when she said it. The next morning, Hallie took a page from her mom's survival book and taught some soccer moves to the obnoxious little kid across the street who she couldn't stand, but whose family was rumored to have some water. In the end, the kid's mother gave Hallie a Dixie cup of water. Hallie sweat more out playing with the little brat, but it was better than nothing. She brought half of the cup to her mom, who refused it and insisted that Hallie drink it all. Now, as they wait helplessly for relief, a lame inspirational quote keeps looping in her mind. You've got to do something you've never done, to have something you've never had. It was something that her soccer coach had told her at some point in her life. However cheesy, it stuck. She assumes it applies not just to the things you've never had, but the things you've had and lost. Things you still desperately need. On the shady side of Target, Hallie runs into her friend, Sydney, who is famous for talking an awful lot but saying absolutely nothing. Is this crazy or what? Sydney says. It's like, what the hell, right? Give me a break or something. But it is what it is, I guess. I hear you, which is generally the best way to respond to her. Then Sydney leans close and says, you want to see something? She surreptitiously opens a pouch in her backpack to reveal a small water bottle. The sight of it takes Hallie's breath away. Suddenly, Sydney is her BFF. Come on, I'll give you a sip, she whispers. They go off towards some bushes, and Sydney pulls out the bottle, shielding it from anyone who might see, like it's something illegal, and lets Hallie take a sip. The sip turns into a gulp before Sydney pulls the bottle away. She's not mad or anything. She must know how hard it is to stop drinking once you've started. Where'd you get it? Hallie asks. You didn't have any when I saw you yesterday. Sydney nods off to the side, and Hallie turns to see that she's indicating the red Volkswagen bus. The driver is leaning up against it now, having a smoke. Late 20s or early 30s, ponytail, bushy sideburns, torn jeans that don't read as a fashion statement. He's giving out free water, Sydney says. But he's kind of picky about who he gives it to. I mean, he can't give it to everyone, you know? Then Sydney lets off a nervous little chuckle that gives away the cold, hard reality that there's no such thing as free water. And Hallie realizes why she hasn't seen Sydney until now. She was one of the three girls who just got out of the little red bus. He's not mean or anything, Sydney says. He even gave me a bottle to take to my family. Hallie watches as a pretty girl she doesn't know gets into the van. The ponytail guy holds the door open for her, pretending to be a gentleman instead of slime. Hallie turns to Sydney. Thanks, but no thanks, she says, and tries to stride away with sufficient indignation, but Sydney grabs her arm. Don't be stupid, Hallie. Haven't you figured it out? No one's coming to help the people here. They're probably all gonna die of thirst. You don't want to be one of them. But Hallie still can't let herself believe that. These things just don't happen here. But Sydney still won't let her go. She looks desperate now. Why do you even care what I do? Hallie blurts out. You got your water. Why don't you just leave me alone? And Sydney finally spills her true motive. He said he'll give me another bottle if I bring him someone. Someone like you. Hallie wrenches her arm away and runs, not looking back. But before she gets to her mother, there's a sound up above. A chopper. And this one is louder. Closer than any of the others. Everyone stands up, looking to the sky like a starry-eyed mob waiting for the rapture. The helicopter appears over the treetops. It isn't big. It's one of the non-military ones that the woman was speaking of. It circles above the mob. It circles again. It circles a third time, and by the third time, Hallie realizes that it's just a news helicopter. It's come to show the world the drama of crisis and the true meaning of desperation. She wonders if the news crew up above even realizes the hope they're shattering by their mere presence here. Once more around, the chopper leaves. People keep on standing, refusing to believe it's gone. As long as they stay standing, it might come back. It might. It might. Bastards, says her mother. Hallie looks at her. She looks to the curb. She looks at her mother again. You've got to do something you've never done to have something you've never had, Hallie thinks. Or something you may never have again. I'll be back, she tells her mother. I promise. Then she heads toward the little red Volkswagen bus where the man with the ponytail opens the door for her. Like a gentleman.
Henry.
The secret to a successful group collaboration is a dynamic, responsive leader. And the key to being a good leader is acute observation and subtle manipulation. So subtle that no one knows they're being manipulated. Come to think of it, that's also the key to a successful government. As we drive, I stay quiet, which is against my nature but necessary at the moment. I watch, I listen, I take mental notes. So we have our 4x4, Jackie says, and turns to Psycho Ginger beside her. Where do you want me to drive it? I told you, Kelton says, Angeles National Forest. So how do we get there? Jackie asks with a vague but persistent threat in her condescension. I'm not sure. I've only been to the bug out twice, but I know exactly where it is on a map. Alyssa instinctively takes out her phone, but gets an error message as she tries to open the app. Damn, she says. Maps isn't working. So use Waze, suggests Garrett. Although I want to laugh at that, the way Jackie does, I say very graciously, I think what your sister means is that there's no service. But maybe there's an actual map in here. Some people still use those, believe it or not. Right, says Alyssa, and our uncle might be one of those people. I smile. Point for me. There's nothing in the glove compartment but the registration, gum wrappers, and a lint roller. The door pockets yield only an empty can of Red Bull, a leaky pen, and more gum wrappers. And then Kelton checks in the center compartment between the front seats. There's no map. But he does pull out a questionable sandwich-sized Ziploc bag. What the... He tosses it to Alyssa like it's a hot potato. Alyssa examines it. No question, it's a bag of weed. She turns to her brother, and they say simultaneously, Uncle Cannabis. Well, says Jackie, we might be dying of thirst, but now we won't even care. The mention of thirst makes Garrett open his canteen, only to find it's dry as a bone. The forest is north of Pasadena, right? I say. We can take the 241 to the 91 to the 57 to the 210. That will get us close. Not gonna happen, says Jackie. The freeways are dead. Both directions. All of them. There are other ways to get there, says Kelton. Non-traditional ways. But we'll need a map to get us started. Suddenly, up above, a military helicopter roars past at a low altitude. We pass a military truck heading in the opposite direction from us, but other than that, there are very few cars on the road. Then, up ahead, we come to a roadblock, also military. Soldiers in camouflage are gesturing to the left and yell to us, This road is for official business only. Take a left. Signs will lead you to the evac center. Don't listen to him, says Kelton. The last place we want to be is an evac center right now. What do you suggest I do? Asks Jackie. Crash through the roadblock? Do you even see the size of the guns they're all holding? Turn left, I say before Alyssa can say it. Do what he says for now, until we find a way around the roadblocks. And although Jackie clearly doesn't want to take any orders from me, she has to. There is no other viable choice except to follow, and reinforce my benevolent leadership. I agree, says Alyssa. Point for me. We turn left, heading down El Toro Road. There are a few more cars on the road with us now, and more roadblocks. It seems that any and all civilian traffic is being directed onto this road. We should be going in the opposite direction, says Kelton. Don't worry, I tell him, forcing a big brotherly tone. Two steps forward sometimes requires one step back. What? Did you get that off a motivational poster in your counselor's office, Roycroft? Says Jackie. How about this one? Sometimes in life you're just plain screwed. All right, can we just kill the attitude? Says Alyssa. It's not helping anything. It's the perfect setup for what I'm about to say next. It's all right, Alyssa, I say with an infinitude of understanding. Jackie's stressed and scared. It's how she deals with it. Don't you dare analyze me, she snaps, which just proves my point. Alyssa glances at me, and I offer her a small grin and a shrug. In return, she offers me a commiseration of raised eyebrows, which is one step before a friendly smile. A fine turn of events. I'll admit that she's still in charge here, but she's beginning to see the two of us as a team. This is excellent progress toward a sustainable dynamic. Once she starts deferring to me, I'll know that I've slipped into the virtual driver's seat, regardless of who's actually driving. Now there are more cars on the road around us, and all traffic is detoured right. I begin to realize that we have entered a funnel leading directly to El Toro High School, where they've set up an official evac center.
I don't think I've ever seen so many people in one place. Crowds in the parking lot, crowds in the fields and the tennis and basketball courts, except for one set of courts that's being used as a helipad. The military helicopter we saw before idles there, offloading water behind an entire gauntlet of armed soldiers. Up ahead of us, a soldier motions for us to pull over to the side of the road, along with the other cars. "We can't let ourselves be herded and corralled like sheep," says Kelton. "This is how it all starts. This is the beginning of the end." "Wow, that's bleak," Jackie comments, which says a lot coming from her. But Kelton holds firm. "We'll have to tell them we got lost. Then we'll turn around before it's too late." A soldier raps on Jackie's window, and she has no choice but to roll it down. "Park here," he says. "Then follow the crowd." "We're here by mistake," Jackie says, heeding Kelton's warning. "Yeah," adds Kelton. "We have somewhere else to go." The soldier isn't buying it. "Then why aren't you already there?" And then Garrett, giving his best puppy dog eyes, says, "My grandma. Please, we have to get my grandma. She's waiting for us." The kid's clever. I'll give him that. And then he adds, "She wouldn't leave her dogs," which is the perfect cherry on his story. This kid should run for office. Hell, I'd cast an uninformed vote for him. Then the soldier says, "Give us her address and we'll send someone for her." That leaves Garrett completely speechless, and before any of us can keep his little fiction balloon from popping, the soldier leans in, looks down at Garrett and says, "Mind telling me what that